We left the kingdom of Judah with the story of Hezekiah. That was the last thing we had. If you look at page 91 a minute, we'll get reoriented here. Page 91. The place we left off was in the right-hand column and number 13. Now we'll go back to the kingdom of Israel, and the place we left that off quite a while ago was Dynasty 5, Jehu. You remember Jehu, the successful chariotizer of surplus queens, the fast chariot driver, Jehu, the stormy go-getter and revolutionist who overthrew and destroyed the whole family connection of Ahab and Jezebel, as far as he could reach them. Now, that was a grim and grisly business. I don't think Jehu was a nice person at all. He did a very terrible job, which, however, had to be done. Don't get the idea that God was pleased with everything about Jehu, for surely he was not. However, he did do a job that had to be done. And he was promised a reward for this. So what was the reward that Jehu was promised for exterminating the Ahab family? Well, what was it? Mr. Estoffi, do you know? Jehu got a reward. Well, he became, that's just part of it. He was king for a day, yeah. Yeah. His family would reign over that kingdom for four more generations. Now, if you count Jehu himself, it makes five, but if you count just his descendants, which is what the promise was, it would be four after him. And this was fulfilled. And this is Dynasty 5. It's the longest single dynasty in that kingdom, 88 years. Now, today we will finish this kingdom, clear down to the 19th king. Some of these will not say anything about except just to mention them as we go past. But you notice in this northern kingdom the extreme political instability. Nine dynasties, 19 rulers, but nine different dynasties or families of kings in slightly over 200 years. This is extremely unstable and is a result of the people's unfaithfulness to God. There is a verse in the book of Proverbs that says, "For the transgressions of a land, many are the rulers thereof." That is the rapid and repeated changes in government are a result of the sinfulness of a country. And you should also realize that while the word revolution is popular with some people today, revolution is extremely costly in human values, life, security, property, and the things that make life worth living. And countries that have one revolution after another, said some South American countries almost have the coup of the month. This is very costly in human values, and one of the greatest blessings that God can give us is to live under a government that is stable. You realize the United States government, with all its faults, and some of them are bad ones, is older as a continuous organization than any government in Europe, with the possible exception of Switzerland and one or two others. They have been overthrown repeatedly. Germany had the Third Reich, and France is having the Fifth Republic, and so on. And we live under a government that is relatively stable. It's not perfect, of course, but this northern kingdom, extremely unstable. Now then, Jehu, followed by Jehoahaz, followed in turn by Joash, this man we met with already. He's the one that, this is not the Joash that was crowned king at the age of seven. This is the one that sent a message to Amaziah, king of Judah, and said, "The thistle that was in Lebanon said to the cedar tree in Lebanon, give your daughter to my son to wife." And the wild beast tromped on the thistle. That's this man. He fought a war with the kingdom of Judah and won. followed now by Jeroboam the Second, who doesn't make very much space in the Bible because he was not a godly man at all and not very important from the standpoint of God's plans, but he is a connecting link in this history. Jeroboam the Second, a long reign, 782 to 753, and politically a real success. Why do you suppose they call him Jeroboam the Second? Well, who is the Queen of England today? Elizabeth. What is the rest of her title? Elizabeth the Second. Why is she called Elizabeth the Second? Because there was an Elizabeth the First. All right, back in Shakespeare's day, you know. And so this one called Queen Elizabeth the Second. And some of the kings, you know, there's King Henry up to the fifth or so of them, and King James and so forth, but this man is not called Jeroboam the Second in the Bible. It's Jeroboam. And neither was the other one called Jeroboam the First in the Bible. But we have to distinguish these two people, and we're going to avoid getting mixed up. So the first is Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. He was the first of this line. And now Jeroboam the Second is not related to him. He happens to have the same name, but is of a different family. This man is a descendant of Jehu. Now, Jeroboam the Second, followed by Zechariah, the last of the Jehu kings, who fulfilled the prophecy or promise that four generations of Jehu's line would reign. He only lasted 6 months, however, and met his death. Now, I think we've had a good bit about kings and queens. I'll just say a word or two more about Jeroboam the Second, and then we'll take up some of the religious conditions and the prophets that prophesied during his reign. Jeroboam the Second succeeded in reconquering what today would be called Jordan, Transjordan, the part of his kingdom on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, you remember Ahab got killed while they were fighting over there trying to get Ramoth-Gilead back from the Syrians. Later, they didn't get it that time. Later, they got it. Then they lost it. And then it wavered back and forth. And Jehu, who was very successful at driving over queens in the driveway, was not very successful at standing up to the real foreign enemies of his country. And he lost everything east of the Jordan, and they didn't get it back till this man, his great-great-grandson here, his great-grandson, Jeroboam II, who got it back. And at this point in the reign of Jeroboam II, for the second time in Bible history, the people of Israel held all the land that God had promised to Abraham, or if not quite all, virtually all, practically all, and near enough that you could say it was a fulfillment of the promise. The first time would be, well, when would it be when they held this the first time? Who was it, Ruth? Well, not David, Solomon, son of David. Yeah. Under Solomon, they held all the land from the Euphrates River to the border of Egypt. God promised this to Abraham. Now they lost it again. And here again in the time of Jeroboam the Second, but this time you have to take two kingdoms together, Israel and Judah, to make out the case. But this time again, they held all or practically all of the territory from the Euphrates River, where it comes nearest to the sea, to the River of Egypt, which is not the Nile, but a wadi or brook that is the border. Yeah, Mr. Rose.
Is that promise to be fulfilled again?
Well, this is a controversial matter. Some people believe that there's a common statement that it must be future because it has never been fulfilled. Now, I, in my opinion, it has been fulfilled twice already, and that this was not an unconditional promise, that the promise that the Messiah would be descended from David is an unconditional promise. This does not depend on people's good conduct. God's going to carry this out anyhow. But the promise that Israel would inherit the land is contingent upon covenant faithfulness. And when they became apostate, they were thrown out of their land, as we'll see a little later in this course, in the Babylonian captivity. Now, the idea that the present-day Republic of Israel is heir to the promises made to Abraham will hardly stand examination from a Christian standpoint. Even from the Orthodox Jewish standpoint, the Republic of Israel is secular. They are sharply polarized between the Orthodox rabbis and the secular party, most of which believe in socialism more than they do in the Bible. But it is a secular affair. Zionism, started 100 and some years ago by a German Jew named Theodor Herzl, is a secular, nationalistic, social and political movement rather than religious, and to get a homeland for the Jews, but on a secular and sociological and nationalistic basis. And therefore, the promises to Abraham are made good to those who share the faith of Abraham. And you can hardly claim this, even on a Jewish basis, of the present Republic of Israel. And certainly the true faith of Abraham is fulfilled by Christians, as the New Testament brings out, at least from our point of view it is. So I am skeptical about the return of the Jews to Palestine being a fulfillment of that prophecy, and I think you can make out a case it's been fulfilled already. But in any case, this depends upon obedience to and faith in the covenant promises and commandments of God. And so that's my answer to that one. Now then, they got it back, and they were great, and everything was buzzing and humming. And they had the highest standard of living they'd ever had, with one exception, and that was during the reign of Solomon. It was perhaps as high or higher. But during the reign of this man, Jeroboam II, they had the affluent standard of living. That is, a great many of them did. On the other hand, there were the terribly poor who were callously disregarded by the rich. Now, during the reign of this king, God had not abandoned these people. They had pretty much abandoned God, all right, but God hadn't abandoned them. You know, it's a good thing that when we forget God, he doesn't forget us, because if this forgetting went both ways, I'm afraid we'd wouldn't be much hope for us. God hadn't abandoned them. They've abandoned God, but God continues to plead with them, and he sends prophets to witness to them and try to win them back to himself, away from their false religion and their general apostasy. They don't obey these prophets. They only get worse. But God, you see, has cleared his name in sending prophets, and it shows that God continued to love them and to want to get them back to their true faith as descendants of Abraham and heirs of the covenant. Now, there were three great prophets that prophesied during the reign of this man, Jeroboam II. And these three are Hosea, Jonah, and Amos. Now, we'll pass Hosea and Jonah by. Jonah, as my good friend and colleague, the Reverend Mr. McMillan, now dean of students, said to a class, is the prophet who went to sea by sail and returned by sin. Good bit, the first submarine ride. Greatly ridiculed at the present day, let me tell you, however, there are two modern parallels to it. Back in the 1800s, the British whaling fleet twice lost a man overboard and harpooned the whale and cut him open and rescued the victim. He was in an unconscious state, and however, he recovered. His skin was paper white the rest of his life, but he recovered. And it wasn't even a miracle. So don't be too sure that what is described as having happened to Jonah couldn't have happened. It is, of course, represented as a miracle. Did I tell you in this class what a kid said on Art Linkletter's program about Jonah? Did you hear that? I don't want to say the same one twice. The Art Linkletter's program. Kids say the darndest things. You know this program? Have you ever listened to it? Well, it's rather quaint. I think it's unrehearsed. It's supposed to be. He asked one kid, what's the last thing your mom said before you came to the studio? Make sure your pants are zipped. Now, this little fellow, aged about four, had told the story of Jonah on Linkletter's program, and he told it very well, too, quite accurately as it is in the Bible. And he got through, and he said to this whale or sea monster, vomited Jonah up on the shore. That's right, Sonny, you told it right. You know your Bible stories. Now listen, Sonny, what lesson do we learn from this story? The kid blinked and swallowed and said, people make whales sick. Now, that's Jonah, we'll leave him. The third of these prophets is Amos. And we'll take up Amos a little while today. And this is in the minor prophets near the end of the Old Testament. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Nahum, and so forth. Amos. Now, this prophet Amos is quite a character. He was not a citizen of this northern kingdom. Evidently, prophets up there were in extremely short supply. In other words, there weren't any. And when God wanted a witness born to those people, he had to import a prophet to do it. So he gets Amos from the southern kingdom. Amos comes from a town named Tekoa, T-E-K-O-A, not very far from Jerusalem. But the kingdom of Judah, you see. And he is sent by God up there to bear a witness to these people in the time of King Jeroboam II. Now, a little bit about Amos. He's a grassroots character, rough and ready, completely lacking in sophistication, never known to call a spade a shovel. Amos tells it like it is, and he tells it very plainly and bluntly. Without formal education, but no college degrees, you know, but evidently a literate man, or he couldn't have written this book. And he had a job. You know, God doesn't look around for somebody who has nothing to do and then appoint him to be a prophet. He finds somebody that's already working at something. Amos had a job. It was a humble but an honest job. You know, it's better to be an honest garbage collector than to be a crooked politician. It's better to be an honest person at a humble job than to be rich and prosperous and be a crook. Amos had an honest job, as will come up later in the story. Now, his job was a double one. It was right close to the soil, too, as most everybody's was. He was a herdman, looked after livestock. This probably means cattle and sheep. And a dresser of sycamore figs. Now, this requires explanation. There were two kinds of figs that grew in the Holy Land, and one of them were much better than the other. This has nothing to do with the sycamore tree that we know in this country. Sycamine, it should be spelled, and this was an inferior type of fig. They weren't good, and nobody but the poorest people would eat them, but some people did. And these sycamine figs, every one of them at a certain stage in the formation of the fig got a bug or a grub in the fig, which if left alone would occupy the entire interior of the fig and make it inedible. But they learned that you could do something about this. A man with a sharp pointed needle or thorn on the end of a stick went through the fig orchard and jabbed, poke, 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 a very monotonous job, make a little puncture hole in every fig. The grub inside would gratefully make his exit to outer space and leave the fig, and the fig would then mature normally and could be eaten, although they weren't considered very good. A very monotonous, humble, and poorly paid job, but it was at least a job, and it was an honest job. So this was Amos. Now, he is sent to the northern kingdom to witness for God against the sins and idolatry, and especially the, let's say, glaring social injustice of this northern kingdom. And he has to figure out where to go. He decides to go to Bethel. This is where Jacob had dreamed of a ladder to heaven ages before. Bethel, house of God. This was a crossroads town, two main highways, one going east and west, the other north and south, intersected at Bethel. Also, there was something of religious concern at Bethel. What was there there? What had been put up there by Jeroboam the First? You know, Mr. Corbin, what was there at Bethel? What did Jeroboam put up, Mr. Lewis? Yeah, one of those two golden calves. The other one at Dan, way up in the north. Golden calf shrine. And so this was evidently still in existence, and there was a priest there that was in charge of it, this golden calf. So here's Bethel from every point of view. It's natural. Furthermore, it's just across the line, a very few miles from the borderline between Israel and Judah, just less than a day's walk. And so he could get there easily. So Amos decides to go to Bethel to bear his witness and do his prophesying. And he gets him a podium of some kind, maybe a big rock or something to stand on, and very likely, although the Bible doesn't say where, very likely near this golden calf shrine, and perhaps on a holiday when a lot of people are coming there to worship. This is, it isn't easy what he had to do. Are people generally pleased to hear somebody tell them about their sins? Is this the way to be popular, tell people about their sins? I heard of a liberal minister who said to his congregation, "Dearly beloved brethren, it pains me considerably to feel under some necessity of suggesting that unless some of you repent in measure, there is at least a possibility that some of you may go to hell to some extent." Now, that's a pretty rank understatement, I guess. People do not like to have their sins brought up to them. Now, I'll tell you, minister, clergyman, minister, pastor, priest, or rabbi is on perfectly solid ground to talk about the sins of other people. Any member of the clergy in this tri-state area can talk about racial prejudice in New Orleans and tyranny in Moscow or Peking and morals in Las Vegas. And everybody's in favor of it. Now, this is good stuff. The minister is preaching against iniquity. But just let him start talking about something closer to home that his own congregation are involved in. Maybe there's a nasty feud between two families and they won't speak to each other. And he starts talking about this. Nope. The reverend is getting personal. And they're opposed to it. Now, Amos got a problem. He's got to bear his witness against their sins and get it done before they throw him out of town. And this is hard to do. And Amos is a bit of an amateur psychologist, and he figures out how to do this. Now, as people don't like to have their sins talked about, on the other hand, there's nothing that makes people feel more comfortable than to hear other people's sins talked about that they're not directly involved in. This makes you feel righteous and comfortable. And so Amos decides to use practical psychology. He gets his audience and he starts out talking about the sins of other people. And he goes clear around the border of this northern kingdom, everything except the west side, which was the Mediterranean Sea. There weren't any sins there. But starts out with Damascus, the Syrians, to their north. This is what God has to say about Damascus and the Syrians. Boy, oh boy, are they going to catch it when God deals with them on account of their sins. God hasn't forgotten them. They're going to come in for judgment. And he tells that God is certainly going to punish the Damascus Syrians. Now, there's nothing these people would rather hear. The Syrians had bothered them for 200 years with raiding and the hot and cold war. Amos pauses, and I can imagine he gets a round of applause. Then he starts in again on the other side of the country. Thus saith the Lord, for the transgressions of Gaza, this is the Philistine country on the southwest, and tells what God's going to do to them. Pauses, no doubt another round of applause. And then he goes north again to the Phoenicians, what is today Lebanon, Tyre, rich, prosperous, and wicked. And he tells what God is going to do to them. This would again bring applause. He says they're going to be destroyed. Then he goes to the other side again. Edom, the Edomites, and what God will do to them. And they're going to be destroyed. And then the Ammonites, descendants of Lot, Abraham's nephew. And then the Moabites, also descendants of Lot. And each time he tells about the direst kind of destructive judgments of God that are going to come on these different nations because of their sins. And you know, these people in Bethel, there's nothing they'd rather hear. Just like, I don't suppose we're quite this bad, but if we'd hear that a terrific earthquake had destroyed both Moscow and Peking, I think the State Department would heave a sigh of relief. That the international tensions would be relieved for a while by something like that. So everybody's in favor of this. Then he comes down to his own country, the kingdom of Judah, and tells what God is going to do to them. And I venture the opinion that this drew double applause. Kingdom of Judah, that he came from. And then he pitches the curveball to them, the sins of their own country. And this is different. He tells what's going to happen to the kingdom of Israel because of their sins. And here's part of what he says. This is Amos chapter 2 from verse 6. They have sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. Now, how do you sell the poor for a pair of shoes? Well, you got to have shoes. And the poor man has not been able to buy the shoes or whatever else it was that he absolutely had to have, and has borrowed money and is unable to pay it back. And the creditor to whom this money is owed is merciless, has no compassion, and is going to sell his fellow for a slave to get his money back. Selling the poor for a pair of shoes. This is, of course, merely an example of this kind of oppression. Then flagrant immorality. A man and his father go in under the same maid. This is incest. And so on. And he tells what is going to happen to them. He mentions their idolatry and their unfaithfulness and their immorality and the rich oppressing the poor. Now, this is more than the priest of Bethel can stand, the fellow that operates that golden calf shrine. He goes to the king, Jeroboam, and says, King, do something about that prophet. It's just awful, the things he's saying. The land is not able to bear all his words. His words are so heavy that they're pushing the land surface down. This is figure of speech known as hyperbole, but this is what the priest of Bethel said to Jeroboam II, the king. Do something about that prophet. And the king won't do it. He's not going to get involved with that prophet. He just won't do anything. So later the priest of Bethel has to try to handle it himself. Now before we take up exactly what he said to Amos, might as well mention it now, I guess. When the king won't do it, the priest of Bethel does it himself. He says to Amos, Prophet, get back across that line where you came from, into the kingdom of Judah where you belong, and there prophesy, and there eat bread. Now that was an insult. He implied that Amos was doing this for the money. You see, the priest of Bethel is a religious racketeer. He's doing it for the money. And he therefore cannot believe that anybody else would be, let's say, preaching the gospel sincerely for the sake of devotion to God and the good of people. He must be in it for the money. Religious racketeers can't understand anybody that isn't a religious racketeer. Go back to the land of Judah, and there prophesy, and there eat bread. Let me tell you, the hardest thing about being a missionary in a country like China is that almost everybody thinks you're in it for the money. So they ask me, how much is your salary? Well, I tell them, $1,500 a year. Boy, oh boy, no wonder you're a missionary. That kind of money. So I look up to the religious service. He says, how much you pay for that pair of shoes? I said, dollars. Come on, after the service, and I'll tell you. So he came around after the service. How much you pay for that pair of leather shoes? They were shoes made out of cloth mostly. Leather shoes. $6. This was back during the Depression days. Shoes are a little cheaper than them now. $6. You mean six American dollars? Yeah. Boy, oh boy, more than I could earn working hard for a whole month. And even your Christian friends can hardly believe that you aren't in it for the money. One fellow asked me, how much does the American government pay you for every person you baptize? Boy, if I got paid for the people I baptized, this would be something, you know. Then the American government couldn't care less whether I baptize anybody or not. Now, the priest of Bethel is like this, and he throws this insult at Amos, implying that Amos, like himself, is in it for the money. Now, I'll tell you a story before we continue this on Brainerd Matheny, for whom the field house is named. He was a comparatively successful and rather wealthy insurance man. He had his little ad printed in the cabinet upside down on purpose to attract attention. Brainerd also was an expert at conjuring or sleight of hand parlor magic and used to attend church gatherings, and he would often pull a pack of cards out of the ear of the minister or a pack of cigarettes out of the hairdo of a lady, preferably if he could find one that was known to be strongly opposed to the use of tobacco, pull a pack of cigarettes out of her hairdo by magic. And he used to go and give performances at organizations and clubs, and nobody knew after Brainerd was dead that all the money he got for this he gave to a crippled fellow who had no way of earning a living. It was, a worthy thing that he was doing. Well, this story is about many years ago. Brainerd was coming out of the Pennsylvania Railroad Station in Pittsburgh. And you come out and go down a ramp that matches right and left, and there's a back parkway in the middle, and a sidewalk and a road for cars on each side. And he was going down the right-hand side, and here was a bum accosted him and said, Mister, would you give me a dime to buy a cup of coffee? Now, you don't hear this so much anymore, but back in the 1930s, this was lots of people out of work. This was very common. I'm not sure all those dimes got spent for coffee. But would you give me 10 cents to buy a cup of coffee? And Brainerd, according to the story, drew himself up real tall and looked at this guy and says, hey, Bob, you get over there on the other side. I'm working this side. Now, this is the attitude of the priest of Bethel to Amos. Amos doesn't take it off him. He throws it right back just like a Chinese ping pong ball. Look here, fella. I wasn't a prophet, neither was I a prophet's son. Unlike you, I had an honest job. I was a herdman and a puncturer of sycamine tree. I didn't have to come here to preach to return a living. I had a job. And the Lord said to me, go to Bethel and prophesy. You know, Amos, he didn't even have an expense account. He's doing it on his own. And this prophet insults him this way. Now, Amos doesn't take it off him. He throws it back, and the priest of Bethel was unable to silence Amos. Amos finishes his job and goes home. Now, some of the things Amos said. Chapter 6, we'll have a rundown of some of these. Chapter 6 of the book of Amos. And here he is evidently speaking to an audience of men, probably out of doors and very likely near that golden calf shrine. When we get through with this, I'll tell you what he said to the women of the northern kingdom. It was really something. But here's what he said to the men. Now, we'll just take up part of these. Verse 3 of chapter 6. Ye that put far away the evil day. Aha, so there's going to be a judgment day, is there, prophet? You said there's going to be a judgment day and God's going to judge the world. All right. So what? It's ages in the future. If it isn't going to come for 10,000 years, what do we got to worry about? You put far away the evil day, the day of judgment. Now, at the time when he spoke this, the judgment of God on them was just a few years in the future, when the Assyrians were going to come and wipe them out. But you see, far off. Lots of time yet. We don't have to hurry up to repent. Next item. That lie upon beds of ivory. Now let me ask, do the Geneva Arms apartments have beds of ivory? How about Clark Hall? Pierce Hall? They do, huh? How do you know? Did you used to live there before? You used to be a men's dorm. I didn't mean to change the character or anything. Let me tell you, beds of ivory doesn't mean beds made of ivory, any spring mattress and everything. Beds of ivory only means wooden beds inlaid with ivory ornaments or decorations. However, this was an expensive and exotic luxury product and indicates a high standard of living. All these things Amos mentions here indicate the luxury standard of living of these people. Next item, they stretched themselves upon their couches. Now, this doesn't refer to a 15-minute nap after lunch nor to an honest night's sleep after an honest day's work, but it refers to, let's say, rolling around in the daytime when people of any character would be doing something useful. Next item, that keep the lambs out of the flock and calves out of the midst of the stall. Calves out of the midst of the stall. They get the best beef cattle and bring them in and shut them up in a barn where they can't get any exercise and fatten them up. Now, the people of Israel were not vegetarians from religious principle. They were allowed to eat meat if things rated as clean, but they were practically vegetarians from economic necessity. The land couldn't produce the meat that they could have it frequently. They have it at the Passover, once or twice a year, you know. The Passover once a year, and one or two other feasts in a year. But these people Amos is talking to, roast beef or steak dinner every day. Prime beef, the best. Luxury standard of living. Next item, they chant to the sound of the viol and invent to themselves instruments of music like David. Now, is it a sin to play the fiddle or the guitar or even the saxophone? All right, it isn't. But it indicates a luxury standard of living. When have you got money to spend on the arts? Only after your basic needs have been met. If you're lacking food and clothing and a roof over your head, the money has to go for that first. And when people have a surplus and all their basic needs have been met and they've still got a surplus, then they can go in for art and music and literature and higher education and all these things. So this indicates a luxury standard of living. They're enough ahead of the game economically to go in for music and art. Next item, they drink wine in bowls. Now, I guess these people drank a little wine, but they would usually dilute it 50% with water. But not these people Amos is talking to. They take it straight, you know, and by the wash basin full, not just a little tiny bit. And, you know, when they're through with that one, they like just some more, with the results that might be anticipated. Drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the chief ointment. Now, this is cosmetics. You're talking to the men here. What would you think of a Geneva student of the male sex that would go down to Benson's and say, I'd like a quarter of an ounce of evening in Paris? Is this for your wife, your mother, or your sweetheart? Oh, I use it for shaving lotion. Well, I don't know. I think it was just Herodotus, the Greek historian, writes in his history that the men of Babylon were all sweetly perfumed. National Geographic had an article about Egypt in the glorious 18th dynasty and described a party thrown by an Egyptian man of high status. Lives in a fine mansion with a lot of servants, and the guests come and arrive at this party, and each one or each couple are met at the door by a servant who pins on their hairdo with a sort of a long hat-pin kind of an affair. Well, it looks like a double-dipped Dairy Queen ice cream cone. But it's wax that will melt just above body temperature and impregnated with perfume. And each of them gets one of these on the top of their head, and they go on into the party, and more guests arrive, and the temperature begins to go up. It gets warmer in there, and this melts, and it runs down the front of their clothes and the back and inside down their neck. And the whole place is heavily perfumed with the aroma of this. And the Egyptians think it's the next thing to being in heaven. Now, they can have it as far as I'm concerned, but this is how it was done. Now, these men that Amos is talking to are so ultra-refined and sissified that they go in for cosmetics. Now, is it true there's something about an aquavelva man? Well, this is what the TV tells you. You can shaving lotion. Now, you can get along just fine without it. You don't need it at all. But an aquavelva man. Well, they're all aquavelva men that Amos is talking to. Now here comes the most costly cosmetics, the chief ointments, the best that money can buy, they use. And then the real punchline of all this, the point of all this, they are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph in the face of all this wealth and luxury and high standard of living and everything. The things that really count in life that matter to God, they don't care one bit about. The affliction of Joseph. Joseph was the only one of Jacob's 12 sons, the 11 older ones, that during the early period of their life had any rapport with the religious faith and philosophy of life of his father. And he got treated badly on account of it and suffered for it. And so the affliction of Joseph becomes a sort of a standard expression for the low state of religion in the country. And this doesn't matter to these people. They got their money and they got their cosmetics and they got their wine and they got their beefsteak and they got their ivory bed and they got their music. And who cares that the name of God is being neglected and trodden in the dirt? Now, this is what he said to the men. I was going to tell you what he said to the women. He called them a bunch of fat cows. Do you think he said the kine of Bashan? Student asked me, what does kine mean? Anybody know what kine means? Mr. Gardner, what does kine mean? Well, this is an old English plural of cow. Cow, kine. And in more recent translations of the Bible, it's translated either cattle or cows. Cows of Bashan. Bashan was the region just north and east of the Sea of Galilee that had abundant rainfall. And the grass grew lush and tall and thick, and there the finest beef cattle were raised. Kind of Bashan. They fatten them up. Now let me explain that in Bible times it was not considered undesirable to be fat. They thought it was a sign of prosperity and that you were much better looking if you were, what we would say, very much overweight. This was considered popular and good-looking. But you see, according to Amos, this was a sign of selfish indulgence and laziness, kind of Bashan. And he goes on to tell them what a lazy, self-centered, unconcerned, and generally good-for-nothing bunch they were. Now, do you think any minister in a church in western Pennsylvania, Ohio, or West Virginia would dare to tell the women in his congregation that they were a bunch of fat cows? Well, I don't think you would. Amos had the advantage here. He doesn't have to stay and live with these people. When he gets through, he can up and go home to Tekoa in the kingdom of Judah and leave them to think it over. He didn't have to stay with them. But this is what he said to them. Bunch of fat cows. Now then, we'll leave the prophecies of Amos. He finished his job and was unable to, the priest was unable to silence him. And we'll take up the rest of these kings. One after another, they got the throne by assassination and lost it the same way. Some terrible things. You can read about yourself as you read the Bible record. And the last one, Hoshea, committed the unpardonable international sin of a double cross on the Assyrians. Now, of Hoshea, it is recorded, he was bad, but he wasn't quite as bad as some of the previous ones. How would you like to have this on your obituary, on your tombstone? He was bad, but he wasn't as bad as some of the people in Beaver's Wells. This is a very negative sort of a compliment for this man, Hoshea. He promised allegiance and loyalty to the king of Assyria and was considered his vassal and paid him a tribute. And then on the other hand, he was dickering with Egypt for backing against the Assyrians. And the Assyrians got on to this and came to destroy the kingdom of Israel. And they captured Hoshea, and he disappeared behind the Nineveh curtain, and nobody ever found out to this day what happened to him. You can guess, though, it must have been pretty awful. And the city of Samaria fought on 3 years without its king. And finally fell. They must have had an unfailing water supply and a large stockpile of food to be able to stick it out that long. And finally fell after 3 years of siege, the Assyrian army out there surrounding them. And the result of this was the Assyrians killed a large part of the people, took most of the rest prisoners 800 miles away to the east, and left a scattered, defeated, broken, scraggly fragment of the poorest people there on the land. And then they brought in a miscellaneous collection of tribes of various languages and races from the east and planted them in there where the people of Israel had been. So this becomes a strange, mixed-up situation. And for quite a while, it was all mixed up. Later, they began to intermarry and sort of get solidified as a single people, and these became the Samaritans. Student in this course once put on a paper in answer to the question, what can you tell about the Samaritans? He said, the only thing I know about them is they were good Samaritans. Now, I'm afraid most of them weren't. The Samaritans. Do you know there's a little fragment of them there, less than 200 still alive today. These are descended from the remnant of the northern 10 tribes intermarried with the people the Assyrians brought in. They're different from Jews, they're different from Christians, and they're different from Mohammedans. A little town called Nablus, right near where Samaria used to be. And many of them have moved to this country. And they have the five books of Moses and Joshua. This is the only part of the Old Testament that they recognize, the part that was, let's say, written completely before their time. And just a little fragment of them there today, sort of a curiosity. Unlike the Jews, they observed the Passover with the killing of the lamb and the putting up of the blood, which the Jews no longer do, not even the Orthodox Jews. This is the Samaritans. And I'm afraid most of them were not good Samaritans. The Samaritans hated the Jews, and the Jews hated the Samaritans. It was mutual. They called each other bad names. This is why Jesus chose a Samaritan for that man in the parable who, let's say, had pity on the poor fellow that had been robbed by robbers and bandits and did something for him.